God was proud of this new creature he had made. For him, this one was special, simply the best. Not because of its intricate construction, though it was intricate indeed. Not just because of its staggering potential, though its potential was staggering. No, this one was special because this crown of creation had been made for love. Made to know and love its maker. To be known by him and loved by him. Which is why God, in all the shocking intimacy of his involvement with humanity, breathed into man the spirit of life. And everything would have been fine, just dandy, we might think, if only God had left it at that. If he had not placed a limitation upon the man, a prohibition of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat. Well, it was like asking for trouble. If only God had said, you eat what you like, you go where you want, you do what you want, with whom you want. This is Liberty Hall. Then none of the problems that subsequently emerged would have emerged as they did. Men hate restrictions, boundaries, limits. So why the limitations? Why the rules that were to cause so much pain? If we're to appreciate the full tragedy of the Genesis project, it will be important for us to understand why God said, no, not this thing. We can assume, I think, that it was not merely a desire on God's part to be difficult, to be awkward and unhelpful, acting on some divine whim requiring obedience for the sake of obedience. That would be petty, not divine. Yet it puzzles us that he should so complicate the human condition by placing the restrictions on us, the do's and the don'ts, that get us into such trouble. One possible explanation is that by placing upon humanity boundaries and limits, moral constraints, God was offering us the possibility of becoming moral beings, responsible persons, and therefore persons at all. Not simply a very clever animal, not an angel on automatic pilot incapable of moral choice, but instead a real, risky, warm human being, the pinnacle of his creative daring. This is what makes us unique. This is what makes us special. This is how we know that we are made in the image of God. For the reality is that morality cannot be learned in a vacuum. People need to tell us, we need to be told, advised, where the lines are drawn between what is acceptable and what is not. What is right and what is wrong, and why the distinction matters, is essential to our humanity. This is the tragedy of kids who grow up and no one has helped them understand the constraints of morality upon their life. I remember seeing a father remonstrate with his son in a shop. The son had been caught shoplifting. And the father was giving him such a row, not for shoplifting, but for being caught. If people are simply left to blunder on recklessly, with no control, no guidance, no discipline, the end product is chaos and hurting. Terrible chaos, profound hurting. If living as a moral being has any value, any creative force in our experience, then it should be learned. And how is it learned if not in the responsibility of choosing freely to keep or not to keep the rules? How does a child learn self-control, a sense of responsibility, if not in the compassionate and caring context of parents making rules, parental do's and don'ts? We would be doing our children no good at all if, for fear of upsetting them, we never drew lines, we never said, no, you can't do that. Loving parents say, darling, don't do that. No, you mustn't do that. And while the child may resist and yell the place down and feel frustrated, it will learn the meaning of right and wrong within the context of these limits. And that's a loving thing to give to the child you care about. Anything less is a dereliction. The Bible makes it clear that God wants the best for humanity, longs for his children to be that remarkable and honourable thing, fully human. And that means developing that sense of responsibility for our actions and for their consequences. He offers us that dignity by presenting us with real choices. Without lines being drawn, our humanity operates in an arid no man's land. With restrictions lovingly in place, there is the possibility of resistance, yes, and of error and disobedience for sure, but there is also the possibility of becoming somebody, a real human being. Yet this is the situation perhaps seen too coldly, for God is not interested in making an important philosophical point about the nature of morality, but rather he's concerned with offering the possibility of a real personal love between himself and us. Don't just say you love and honour me, show me. And here's how you can show me, by doing what I ask you. If that relationship is to have worth and meaning, humanity has to be free to choose God or to choose to operate without him. Any other kind of freedom is bogus. Any other kind of love is forced, unnatural and unreal. God doesn't want blind obedience from us, but real love, meaningful love. And now that is possible. For men and women can choose freely to love God and can demonstrate that love by doing what he wishes. Or they can opt to love only themselves and disregard entirely God's requests, God's laws. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil presents not so much a limitation as an opportunity, a possibility, through which Adam can express loyalty and love towards God through submission to the will of his Creator. God does not, in the first instant, want Adam to be good. He wants him to be his. God does not, in the first instance, want Adam to be good. He wants him to be his. And there is no way, no meaningful way, that Adam can choose to be God's if there is not also the real possibility of choosing not to be God's, deciding to disregard God altogether. And the way that choice is revealed is in whether or not he will take the thing that God has expressly told him not to take. A big decision. A big decision. So Adam makes his choice. And the simple, tragic, grim truth is, it is disturbingly reminiscent of the choices so many of us make about God, our response to his desire to know us and share our story. Certainly, like most decisions, Adam's was affected by external influences. The drama of the serpent wheedling his way into Adam's conscience, worming his way into all his good intentions. And let's not kid ourselves, the fruit was tantalising, tempting, attractive. Why did it have to look so tempting? And Eve, she was no help at all, using her wiles and charms to break down his crumbling resistance. It's a heady cocktail that none of us would have been able to resist, I'm sure. Because the truth is, not much has changed. When the temptation to capitulate to evil comes our way, the desire in us to explore the forbidden that stays with us through childhood and to adolescence and sneaks up on us at the most unfortunate moments is very real. The curiosity that kills cats, the beguiling influence of what is acceptable to everyone else, the mutuality of that shared conspiracy that excuses all our moral lapses with the assurance that, come on, we're only human, so none of us needs to feel too guilty. The chip, chip, chip of the media at the already shaky foundations of our moral resolve. They all conspire to nudge our decision-making processes away from light towards darkness, edging us towards more and more bizarre and self-damaging choices that laugh in the face of God and his will for us. And we know it. And we don't give a hoot. Now that's freedom. freedom to self-destruct if we choose. Now, dangerous though all this is, we have to hold on to it. That sense of being responsible, really responsible for who we are and what we become. For all the external pressures on him, we must not demean Adam or anyone by suggesting that somehow, because of the pressures on him, it wasn't really his choice. He had no choice. If he's been pressed so hard from all sides, he had no choice. What else could he do? That will not do at all. That's to degrade our human dignity. It was indeed 100% his personal choice. Despite the clever sales talk, or the pressure from his woman, or the sentimental desire not to leave her isolated in her error, bottom line, he chose. Just as we choose. He freely opted to disregard what God had told him, a symbolic decision that foreshadows all our personal posturings of sturdy independence that have proved so disastrous for humanity. His choice. Our choices. There is no ducking that one. And if we're wondering where God was when all these bad choices were being made, we need to remind ourselves that the decisions are ours to make in the private chapel of our heart. That's our tremendous glory and our terrible burden. We can't look for persuasive signs and wonders to sway us Godward, no writing in the sky to assure us it would be much better, really, if we were to follow God's way and adhere to his will. God tells us what his will is, and has no intention or desire to use undue influence or pressure to shape our decision-making process. God wants Adam to give his allegiance freely and gladly, not compelled, bullied, or tricked. It's his choice in the heady, dangerous freedom of his integrity as a child of God, a spiritual being who enjoyed total responsibility in total freedom. Out of respect for that free personality, God stands back, and Adam moves inexorably and with firm, determined step towards the self-contained world of the creature and further away from home. It's almost masochistic to outline the consequences of the bad choice that Adam, that every man, and all subsequent Adams and Eves make daily. It all sounds so familiar. We understand it because we are it. First the guilt as they run and hide from the one who only wanted to give them love. The guilt they felt was not so much about some abstract breaking of some abstract moral codes. It was because they knew they had done something really hurtful to their God. They hadn't cared enough, loved enough, to do the one thing he asked of them. When in the Old Testament David the king commits adultery, his concern is not so much that he has crossed some legal social barrier, disregarded some local custom or taboo. He says, "Against thee and thee only have I sinned, O Lord." He confesses that not merely social conventions have been ignored, but the heart of God has been wounded. A slap in the face to the one who longed to hold him to his heart. And after the guilt and the hiding, the disruption and disharmony that accompany the disobedience, Adam blames Eve, Eve blames the serpent, and both of them know in their hearts that they themselves are responsible for what they themselves have done. And so the story goes. Eden is lost forever. We read of the social and economic disruption that follows Adam's self-centred choice. For when we turn towards self and away from God, as we drift into independence from him, the shadows gather around our social connections. And we suddenly encounter in a chilling moment the terrible loneliness of our much-vaunted independence from God. And all the individuals who persist in their no to God journey deeper and deeper into the far country and find nothing and nobody there to fill the emptiness within. It's a terrible story. Sad and unsettling, and it has endured so long because essentially it is our story. Betrayal, unrequited love, bad, crazy, self-destructive decisions, It's our tale as each new Adam and Eve, given the choice, opts for the solitary confinement of life without God. This is the greatness of the Genesis account. It touches on the raw nerve of our human existence and reminds us with a poignant emotive power just how far we have drifted from our Eden, from our true centre in the life of communion with God. Is there nothing but sadness and bad news in all of this? Nothing but the tragic, grim reminders of what we've lost? Paradise Lost is just the start of the story. It is followed by the long, wonderful story of Paradise Regained. If Adam and Eve are our story, so too is the long, beautiful catalogue of God's patient, redeeming work in the history of Israel, culminating in the coming of Christ, the Redeemer, called in the New Testament the Last Adam, who draws poor, fallen, broken humanity back into the true focus of the human experience. Adam's tale is the sorry little prologue to the glorious history of God's salvation, which is in itself the story of God's endless love for us as children. A love that is measured in blood, agony, and death on a cross, prepared to go to hell and back to restore the fractured relationship, to put together the shattered pieces of the dream. Perhaps had we not sinned, we might never have known, never been brought to our knees by the cosmic shattering news that God loved the world so much that he gave his son. And we hear the gospel good news, that the story ends not with a bitter tasting dismissal from the garden, but with a welcome to the feast. Love that will never give up. Love that will never let us go.